In the first book of the Bible, the book of Genesis, the first three words are, "In the beginning." Hundreds of years later, in one of the Gospels, the book of John, the first three words are, "In the beginning." The exact echo is not an accident. It's used deliberately to say, once, a long time ago, God spoke and the world began. Now, much, much later, He has spoken again through a person, and there is another new creation. There are other deliberate parallels between Genesis and John. In Genesis, the priestly writer says that in the beginning there was darkness, and God said, "Let there be light." In John's Gospel, the echo says that Jesus Himself is the true light, a light the darkness cannot overcome. In Genesis, God is shown as having only to speak a word, and life begins. In John's Gospel, that word, that life-causing word, is Jesus Christ Himself. It is an assertion beyond logic, one of the high peaks of the poetry of faith, the highest compliment anyone ever pays to Jesus of Nazareth in the pages of the New Testament. I have no idea how literally John meant us to take it. My own feeling is that it is part of the poetry of adoration, part of the reverence built up in the church as it got farther and farther away from the actual details of the birth of Jesus. But I am already ahead of myself in a rather difficult kind of sermon, and I want to back up and go rather carefully. My single interest is in trying to throw light on just two words used in John's preface. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. I can't do much with the phrase "became flesh" until I do something first with a unique word John uses just ahead of it. One might have expected him to speak of the Messiah, that word which meant so much to the Jewish people. But it was a word that meant nothing to Greeks. And John decides to use one of their special words to present the power and glory of Christ to them. So he uses Logos, a word which, so far as I can tell, Matthew, Mark, and Luke would never have dreamed of using. It was a word out of Greek philosophy, a word heard often in the speech of Philo of Alexandria, a word which had even gotten out of the lecture hall and into the streets. The ordinarily intelligent man and woman knew something of this word. My guess is that it had a rather wide, vague, general range of meanings. I'm sure not everyone understood it quite the same. It suggested the knowledge of something, the idea of something. Give Logos an English shape, and you can see it in all those L-O-G-Y endings we are familiar with. Theology, the knowledge of God. Biology, the study of life. Meteorology, the meaning of weather. So what John does and it is an amazing thing, is to say that Jesus himself is the knowledge of God. The essential nature of God himself became flesh and dwelt among us. I hope you are thinking right now how remarkably different this is from the birth stories you read in Matthew and Luke, the ones we always remember in Christmas sermons, because it really is different. John has absolutely no interest in repeating those stories about a census, about shepherds, about a star or a virgin birth, those tangible things that relate the birth of Jesus to things in life that we know at least a little about. What John wants to do is speak of an inexpressibly grand idea and how that idea took on a shape and entered the world. Let's come back down to earth for a moment and try to make sense of it. First, I want you to think about how the human mind prefers the concrete to the abstract, prefers to know a person rather than an idea, or better yet, perhaps, to know an actual person who has made the idea take on a human shape. When the Greeks, for example, wanted to talk about beauty, which is an abstract word, they did it by telling the story of Aphrodite. We know her better as Venus, who stepped ashore out of the sea foam in the most beautiful female shape they could imagine. Now they could paint beauty. They could sculpt beauty out of marble. For them, the idea of beauty had taken on a form. Hardly anything is more abstract than the word wisdom. You can't see or taste or touch wisdom. It's an idea. And if you want to be quite at home with it, you need to have that idea, that word, if you please, take a shape. So the Greeks had a story about how Athena, their goddess of wisdom, stepped fully grown out of the forehead of Zeus, the chief of the gods. How could you do it much better? Wisdom coming from the forehead, from the mind of the father of the gods. Where else? This kind of thing is still immensely appealing to us. I just read a short story in The Atlantic that was all about the slow and painful birth in a redneck of compassion and sensitivity and brotherhood. But those abstract words were never once mentioned anywhere in the story. What I met was a man, South African, white, who came to embody, by and by, through his experiences, all those abstract things. They took a form. They became flesh. I responded to them in a shape familiar to me, a shape like my own. I felt the power of that story in ways far more durable and compelling than if I had read an essay that simply used the word sensitivity and the word compassion and tried to define them. I saw those attributes walking on two legs, expressed through human hands. This is how we live. A little boy I knew had no father. That is, his father left him so soon that he never knew him. And so at 7, he had no father. But by 7, he was hearing the word father. In books, he read it. He heard it on television. He heard it at school. He heard it from his playmates. He could even define the word. He could sing it in a song. He could dream about it in the night. But it was a word, and no more than that. And then one day his mother fell in love again and married a fine, sensitive man who wanted to love her child too. And Jimmy's word became flesh and dwelt in his house. Now do you hear what John is saying? That all through the childhood of the human race, we have heard this word God with its enormous freight of ideas like perfect truth and goodness, holiness and justice and mercy, but it was only a word. Still abstract, still remote. Until one day this word became flesh. Appeared in a shape like ours. Walked and talked in a tiny country at the eastern end of the Mediterranean Sea. This is John's incredible compliment to Jesus, who has by now become no longer the Jesus of literal history, but the Christ of faith. But I can't use that expression without trying to explain it. Surely John, writing as late as he did, had heard the lovely stories of the shepherds on the Judean hills and the wise men coming from far off to lay their gifts before the child, but he left them out. He was perfectly willing for those who read his gospel to miss all that. By the time John wrote, probably a full century or more after the birth of Jesus, there had been time for a fairly sophisticated theology to build up. Nothing against theologies. They are an ordered way of thinking about God, preferable, I'm sure, to a vague fuzziness. But they are not poetry. They are not made out of guiding stars and angelic choirs and simple shepherds and awestruck wise men and a sweet little child born in a stall to a woman touched by God. We cherish those stories, but John had left them far, far behind and passed into a world of thought as far beyond them as Einstein's grasp of physics is beyond mine. It's almost too much for us. Which may be why we keep turning back on Christmas, not to John's austere and soaring flight of intellect, but to the warm human poetry of Matthew and Luke. So I may have to have your forgiveness this morning for having chosen to remind you that there was more than one way of understanding the life of Christ among those who became his disciples. My excuse is that perhaps for grown-ups, it can be appropriate at least once to consider how very different John's approach is to the life of Christ. On Wednesday, on Christmas Eve, we'll return to the poetry. But today, in broad daylight, I wanted John to have his chance to say to us that in the person of Jesus, God has spoken. Truly spoken. Expressed himself as never before. Not like those sometimes childish stories in the older books of the Bible. Not as a sometimes insecure, sometimes petulant, vindictive, and cruel God. But now in grace and truth. In a life of grace and truth. What a lovely compliment. Jesus is the Word for God. No other religion in the world has anything quite like it. This notion that God did not remain remote, but expressed himself in a real person and felt in that person what we feel, our loneliness, our fears, our secret guilts and sorrows. Not a God above it all, looking on from some remote mountain peak, but a God who enters into life, speaks himself through flesh like ours, loves, hopes, dreams, suffers, and dies, just as we do. It may be too much to believe, because the simple truth is that many have never been able to believe it. But it remains one of the most thrilling ideas ever expressed to mankind about the nature of that abstraction we call God. But I am a little embarrassed. Now, we've already been in that rarefied atmosphere too long, and it's true that most of us are not comfortable with abstractions. With relief, our minds turn back to the other way of thinking about the beginnings of the Christian story. The chorus in the dark sky above the sleeping village. The peasant mother far from home. The first sharp cry of a child on that night which, though no one really knew it then, was an extraordinary night. The night of all nights. The night that changed history forever. The night we celebrate with a song. Now, I hope you will hear it as if for the very first time.